Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is Yuri Moreno. Yuri is an entrepreneur who started very early. Actually, let me just shut up here and ask Yuri a quick question. Yuri, how old were you when you worked at your first startup?
Well, when I had the exit was I had 21.
How? When did you start?
I started when I had 19.
At 19. At 19, all I wanted to do was probably attract the opposite sex. So it's very impressive that you started working at a startup. So you started your career at Underdog, and you later co-founded Extra Ball, which are both marketing companies out of Sao Paulo, Brazil, right? And
yes.
You eventually sold both the companies and moved to San Francisco. And I invited you to talk to us about how you built and sold this company so that we can learn from your experience. Yuri, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Just doing a hook in here, what you said, getting the opposite sex was kind of a strategy too. I'll just focus on getting my wallet more prepared to do that first.
Yo, you are smart. You went for the wallet first and you would get many more things and girls would be one of them. Give me a brief background about where you came from.
Sure. I'm Brazilian. Probably some guys can tell by the accent or everything. We have a peculiar accent. A lot of people that I met here just like, oh, you're Brazil. I was like, Brazilian. I was like, how you know? It's like your accent. Mm-hmm. So maybe that. But I come from a small city, São José dos Campos, which is basically like a country city from São Paulo. But as probably all you guys know, Brazil is huge in area. So my city, the number of people that used to live in São José dos Campos, basically the same number of inhabitants that here in San Francisco. So it was a small city in a matter of how developed it is the city. It's still a third world country, right? Mm-hmm. But regarding to size and structure and everything, it could be considered a big city. But anyway, São Paulo is where everything's actually in there. And I just started early on teching, doing a technician course while I finished my high school, basically doing everything together, going to school from 6 to 6, basically, and doing all together. So I finished the high school, got my technician, and that was it. I was already working with ERP software back in the day, something that I don't like. Enterprise research management, for those who are not familiar with it, it's just basically manage all the numbers that a company has. And that was not funny at all, but that gave me a lot of background on really IT, hardware, software, databases and everything. And I used to code back in the days on Delphi, Visual Basic. So I had a pretty solid background on tech to start it out, the marketing venture, basically.
Yeah.
But like I said, that gets me tired. So that got me tired in 2 years, time to finish the training and everything, got a kind of kick off curriculum. And then I was like, I need to move it to São Paulo. I need to figure something there. I want to work with marketing and stuff.
But why the change? You seemed it sounds like the life was going well, right? You were doing your undergrad degree and you had a technician job on the side which was paying well and you were in your hometown. Life was good. What prompted you to move to Sao Paulo?
It was a combination of things. Life was good, but I was ambitious. I wanted more kind of in a way of I need to kind of grow my salary, ramp it up on positions. So I always had that on my mind that if I got stuck in the same job doing the same thing, something was wrong. Mm-hmm. And that was the first trigger. So, and the second one is something that happened was basically I was doing SEO on my spare time. Basically, I was getting home, building some blogs, some websites, and I was like, how can I bring traffic to this? Because I had a blog with 16 years old and nobody shows up or anything. So I was like, I need to start to learn this. So from 16 to 18 until I graduated on the technician and everything, while I was working and studying, also doing some blogs and stuff. And then I started to like really feeling the marketing and all these different aspects that you can use it to build traffic and acquire new users, like SEO, paid traffic, social media, email marketing, and all the stuff. And it gets to a point that when I like kind of finished my training, I was making the same money, basically. I was not getting paid like huge amount of money.
Same money as when you first started.
Yes. As a trainee, okay. I was making about like, I don't know, like $2,000 a month as like Brazilian reais and everything. And my SEO started to pay out $2,000 a month. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, Google AdSense, actually. That was the only source of monetization that I used back in the days.
What was your blog at that time called?
Nadademais.com. The translation from that in Portuguese will be like nothing too much, nothing else. Just like I was bored and tried to look for funny names. And the blog was like a funny blog, just like cartoons and like 90 gag style. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a way to play around and make fun on the web, reposted the things that I found funny.
I
started to put it the AdSense blocks in there. People start to click it when I send the traffic, and I started to make money. Dollars translated to reais was like really good. So I was like, great, let's try to do this instead of working for other people. Mm-hmm. So that was the second one. And the third one, which is the biggest like story of my life, I used to say, is when I went out to a conference, basically to hear a lot of like good speakers that I used to follow their podcasts and everything. And there was a guy in there, Thiago Luiz. In the future, he would be my partner. But at this time of the story, I barely knew him. I just listened to him and everything. I was a fan, but he never like changing emails with me or phone calls, nothing like that. I was strange to him. So I went out to this conference in Florianopolis, and he was had a speech in there. And he was saying something about like how the updates of Google are influencing people, and websites are going down, people are losing clients, agency are like desperate, try to like make it up excuses for the numbers and the updates. And I raised my arm, kind of like started to asking questions for him, like, hey, do you really think that this is not like a bad move on the customer side? Because if it is an algorithm change, they're probably going to get back to you once they figure out that it's not your fault for real. Mm-hmm. And he kind of like thought that there was like, one, I have like some balls to raise my arm and like start to question.
So he mentioned that when a Google algorithm changes, that the customers are going away and blaming him. Then you ask the question, correct. They may be blaming you in the short term, but long term they'll realize and they'll get back. So why is that a bad thing?
Exactly. Okay. I didn't saw it as a bad thing. The whole market was desperate because they were losing clients, right? So that's like a straight up no for them. There's like, something is wrong, we need to move fast, we need to like help these guys to get back to the numbers, because people are firing agencies all the time, like big e-commerce, big retails in Brazil, they're calling the agencies like, hey, my ranks dropped from like first to 30, now I'm like in the third, fourth page of Google. Mm-hmm. You're fired. So like the whole SEO market, the whole digital marketing agencies in Brazil was desperate from that kind of reaction from the clients. And I was like, that's actually like, it is bad on the like in immediate terms, but not at all when they realize that they fire you because of the wrong thing. It was basically what Ren Fishkin, a lot of guys probably know him, like a really good guy from SEO market area. Here in US, and he was having kind of the same position. Like he had a lot of clients that went away, that fired Moss as their SEO agency, and they went back a few months afterwards saying like, oh, sorry, we realized there was like not your guys' mistakes or anything, it's just like the way that Google is behaving now, please help us get back to the first page again. So when something that happens, actually good for you, right? Because you can charge more, you have more leverage on top of the client. So that was my point, basically, on his speech, why he was speaching. Of course, I raised my hand. I didn't, like, shut it out or anything. I didn't want to, like, make him look bad or anything. That was not the intention at all. But no. He liked because I stepped it up, and I put it a great point, basically, a good question.
Yeah. So when he was impressed with your questions and challenging nature and inquisitiveness, what did he do?
I came to him in the end of the speech when he gone down to the stage and everything. I was there just to shake his hand because, like I said, I was a fan, so I was just like, "I'm sorry, I didn't want to like bother you or anything. Thanks so much for like give me the voice, let me speak in. I really appreciate your work." And he was like, "Thank you and everything. Are you doing something right now?" I was like, "No, I'm actually looking for a new opportunity and everything." It's like, "Why don't you drop by to São Paulo at my office and we can chat? Can you do it this week?" I was like, "Hell yeah." I didn't even knew if I had something scheduled or whatever. I was like, "I'm going. Doesn't matter what or how, I'm going." That was like my, like, wow. When a big guy from a big agency comes and say like, "Hey, come to my office and let's talk." From me, it was just like, Elon Musk was calling me to like have a coffee with him. I was like, "Yeah, for sure." Super young, super naive, first geek in the marketing area. I was really excited.
Was that when you were 18 years old?
Exactly. I was 18 years old on the time. I just graduated, finished my trainee and everything. So I was like trying to figure out what I was going to do. If I would stay on doing AdSense forever or what else I'm going to do. So he called me. I didn't even bother. That was not my hometown city or anything. I just like, I need to have this talk with him. That's going to be grateful. And eventually it was. I went down to the office, had the meeting. Was really brief meeting, like 30 minutes or less. He just like kind of asked more questions about like really my personality, things that I like, things that I didn't, how I would behave in XY situations. He didn't test me my skills at all. That was something really impressive. He was like really trust me from whatever I told him or whatever. So he sent me the paperwork. He sent me some like, then I received some like kind of like assignments, I would say, like do that and that and that. Probably would evaluate me on that. I reply everything promptly right at the day they send me. They kind of love this quick feedback and everything. And from that on, I received the proposal letter to start as a SEO specialist for one big client, like a client around like $1 million per month budget.
I see. How big were they at that time when they hired you?
They were really small. They were like, it was two partners and three employees, if you count with like the front desk girl and everything. So I was like the fourth employee in there.
I see. And you were at Underdogs for a while before you started the other company, right? And you told me earlier at a different conversation that at this time, there were also many other big marketing agencies in the market.
Yeah, that was exactly the name. Why the name actually was Underdog. Because Thiago, when he founded the company, he used to be VP of Wonderman and one of the biggest like digital marketing agencies in Brazil, and even has like a headquarters in Miami. And he was basically letting go like a big VP role, a big salary and everything to just like go and try to make his own kind of path and open the Underdog agency. And that's where the name came from, because he was totally Underdog.
Yeah.
Back in the days when I joined the company, I didn't even knew what is an Underdog was. But the name was because of this. He was fighting with the big players in Brazil. Like the guys who like we started to work were basically before us. They were managed by like the same teams that used to manage Coca-Cola, John Walker, and like huge brands in Brazil and worldwide. That's why the Underdogs.
So they had no connection to the SEO world as such before.
For what?
No, you said the people who were managing were ex-Coca-Cola, other industry employees. Is that right?
Yeah, it was big agencies that used to manage big accounts. So we were fighting with these guys. Like,
oh,
these
got
guys
it. Okay.
Have such a great, such a huge portfolios of companies on their pockets. Uh-huh. They were like, "You're really going to try to take the clients out of their plate? You're crazy." You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, like I just joined the company and he had the name. But the second one, Extra Ball, did you mention on the beginning, the name was coming together and everything. Thiago had way more like credit on the name too, because he's really creative on this part. But Extra Ball was because we already had the Underdog working and was going great. on the time, and we kind of feel like a need, a demand on the market for a front end agency to do like Magento, VTax, WordPress, mainly VTax because that's the biggest platform on Latin America for e-commerce. Mm-hmm. And Extra Ball was like a second shot. So just like in the pinball game, when you have like another ball as a bonus or anything, that's your extra ball. That was the company name because of this, because it was like our second chance. We already did it with the agency, the digital marketing agency. Now let's try it with the front end agency. And it worked well. So actually Extra Ball was grow really, like really fast, actually faster than Underdogs.
So so before we go into the Extra Ball and what you did there, I wanted to know in your Underdogs, how did you guys standard from the other people in the market? Because they were all big guys, right?
Yes. Basically, branding was the main thing in there and how we play up this card. Thiago always had the idea of doing like a premium agency. So that's why we're fighting with the big guys, because we went after their big clients. Mm-hmm. So we're not like a small agency that's just going to serve a bunch of small and medium business. We didn't want to go this route. We didn't want volume at all. Actually, we had like a internal cap of like 5 clients. Inside the company, we agreed upon not getting more than 5 clients at the same time so we can really like take care of each one of them. Mm-hmm. So this is a position of only like huge agencies that play this kind of game, because you really need clients that pay like millions more per month so you can like really have only 5 clients instead of like 30s, 50s.
So you're directly going only for the big guys?
Yes.
But what did you do that...
Top down. Totally.
Oh, I see. So what did you do that the big guys were willing to work with you and not with the other big marketing agencies out there?
I would say 2 things. First, Thiago had a big role on it because he has such a great name in the market as vice president of Wonderman, and people knew he from his speeches and everything. So they knew he was a great professional. Mm-hmm. And it was exactly like his agency. He founded from the ground and everything. And
so he was established as like a thought leader.
Yes. For sure. Especially on the PPC market, like paid advertising, like Google AdWords and that kind of stuff.
Got it.
There was really a powerful name on that segmentation. Basically, the second thing was that we kind of like give the same speech that I just gave it to you, to the clients, like, hey, we're premium. You're going to come over here. We're going to just work with you. We're going to have like 5-10 people working just on your account. Different than other agencies in Brazil that we're going to share resources. And one project manager is taking care of like 30 different projects. No. Here, one guy is taking care only of your project. This SEO dude is only looking to your SEO. This PPC guy is looking to your AdWords account every minute, every 30 seconds. So that was like a really premium kind of like service solution. And that's what attracts them, because they really wanted to like get the phone and have someone like prompted to answer the questions, or get someone like replying their email in seconds with problems on the account. So we're kind of like not an in-house team, because we're not based upon the client's company, but we're 100% dedicated to them. Mm-hmm. So that was thing that really attracted in and put a lot of trust on us.
So you were positioned as a premium player, and were you also pricing your services that way?
Correct. That was the only way to live. That's the only way to pay all the bills and everything with like just 5 clients.
I see. And this was founded in 2011, right? Early 2011, the Underdog. And why? Mm-hmm. And then later, Extra Ball was later in 2011, I believe. I see from LinkedIn here. What prompted you to start the new company?
What was the demand on the market? Like, we used to do the marketing for all these retails and everything, and these guys were always complaining about their front end agencies. They cannot hire good developers and everything. So we're like, wow, every time like we sit it down, here it is, we can do nothing. We just basically can we can only refer them to another agency or another guy that would provide the same solution. And I started to tell my partner, like Thiago, I was like, don't you think we're losing money here?
Because losing money in what? I'm sorry, I didn't follow. What part of the marketing that your firm was not offering that was valuable to the client?
The front end developing.
What is front end developing?
Basically, all the CSS, HTML, JavaScript. So like the look and feel of the website, whatever is the coding, the developing that the user sees.
I see. And so you guys before that were only focused on analyzing the data once it is collected. And the front end is a part which actually collects the data and interacts with the user.
We're only focused on marketing solutions. This is a totally developing agency. So we're doing marketing with underdogs. And when people used to come to us and say like, hey, why am I not making sales? One good reason was like, hey, because your website doesn't convert. Mm-hmm. We bring the visitors, it's quality traffic, it's proven good, but a lot of people drop off, for example, on your shopping cart. Why? Mm-hmm. Because the website sucks, because the guys want to put another quantity on their product and the websites crush it, because it wants to remove or update your shopping cart and it breaks it, it has a bug, or the user cannot see the checkout button, like obvious stupid things like that. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, okay, so you can fix it for me? And we're like, no, sorry, we're a marketing agency. We don't do front end.
Got it. Okay, so it's more of a development and other things. And there was a need from the market. So which do you remember which customer first asked you, which prompted you to build this new company? What was the breaking factor or what pushed you over the edge?
The first, the breaking factor is totally the demand, mm-hmm. because we heard a lot from the requests from our clients. Mm-hmm. And when we used to go to talk to with like business partners, like platforms and other like companies in Brazil, the people from platforms are like, hey, don't you guys have someone good on front end? Because we have a lot of customers asking for, they got stuck, they cannot put their websites on air because the platform is all configured, set it up, ready to go, but they didn't finish the front end part on the website. Mm-hmm. So we noticed from this demand coming from everywhere. That's why come up the idea of like, hey, maybe we're losing money here. Maybe we could build a solution here, another company or something else and try to make money on that.
Yeah.
And that was the main point of it. But our first project, as you asked, was Daslu. Uh-huh. Still online. It's still a huge brand in Brazil. It's Daslu, Daslu. And it's a fashion premium clothing store. So has usually towards girls, but has some male fashion in there too. And we did their kind of like the blog integrated with the retail, with the e-commerce shop. So that was the first project. We did it as like a kind of a beta alpha to them, which like, hey, let us do it for you. If it didn't work, you don't pay anything. We took 100% of the risk basically. And they were like, okay, we trust you guys. We're not having any risk, financial risk in here. Let's give it a try. We did it. We delivered the thing in like 2-3 weeks. They were like amazing by the speed that we deliver, which is not that great, but probably the other people that were working before was even worse. So in 3 weeks, we make them hell of happy and they pay with this smile on their faces. And we're like, alrighty. Okay, we have some cash in here. Let's build a company. Let's hit the ground.
Yeah. So that was your first project which gave you cash to found your company and do that.
Yeah, one important thing to mention is that I was hired as employee when, like I just said, Thiago liked me and hired me as SEO specialist for the client. And 9 months afterward, he invited me to be his partner on Underdogs itself.
Yeah.
So when we started Astroball, I was already a partner at Underdogs.
Yeah.
So Thiago was like, hey, we work well. You're my partner for that many times. It was 4 months, actually, not that much, 3-4 months. And it was like, we've seen this demand. This is Daslu project works. Want to do it? And I was like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, so I was curious about that. I was going to ask you about that. There were many employees in Underdogs, right? And he could have chosen anybody to be his partner or co-founder. What did you do that separated you from the rest, which made you the partner at Underdogs and the co-founder at Extra Ball?
I don't know, but I can name a few things that I guess that was in his head, whatever, make me so appealing to that position. Basically, I was a hustler. I'm still a hustler. I consider myself. So I was almost the first one to get in there and the last one to leave, kind of every day. And I didn't mind if I had work to do or not. I just went there, sit my ass, study, watching some webinars, doing some notes, providing ideas, strategies for the clients, even if they don't ask it. I was on top of my game every time. And I was trying to be like that constantly. So that was the first thing. The second one, I always joke about buying the company too. Like, I knew that the company had a good valuation back in the day and everything. And I was still employed. So I was like, hey, I'm going to eventually come up with some money here and make you a crazy offer that you're not going to be able to refuse, like the Godfather style. And I'm going to take care of the whole organic acquisition here. I want to take care of the SEO and even the pay one if you let me. But I'm going to buy some shares of your company and become your partner. So I was kind of like push it a little bit, joking about it, and I think he took it seriously.
Yeah. There is, you're joking, but only half joking, right?
Something like that. I was half joking for sure, because I'd had my intentions to grow up and to play a major role in there. I didn't thought that would be that quickly, but glad that things work out.
So within the first 2 years, we were talking earlier about it as well. You're telling me that you had some revenue or profitability problems.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Basically, the thing was that running the agency with the whole overhead that we had in Brazil was really hard. And mainly because of two things. One, Brazil, like legal part when it comes to like W-2s, 1099s, just like formal employees, it's really hard, really tricky. You have a lot of taxes on. You really like, we used to say that if some employee suits you, you will never be able to win. Like the employee always take it. You're basically gonna come up to a deal or anything, put some money on the guy's hands and let the process go away, because it doesn't worth fighting for. So that's one big issue we had. And like I said, like you mentioned, we have more than 30 employees at this time in two offices. One is in São Paulo and the other one's south of Brazil. We decided to take this route, another one in the south, because south is a little bit cheaper, the labor itself.
In the south?
Actually, Curitiba.
Curitiba.
Curitiba, it's a big city in Brazil too. So Curitiba has a little bit of a cheaper labor. So we started like putting developers and other people in there. Just like Curitiba office was a third, a fourth of the size of São Paulo. São Paulo was the big thing, and where we used to invite clients and they come up to the office and the office looks great and everything. So getting back to the topic here, it's 30 more employees. So it's really hard to manage all the details, the paychecks and everything, keep everybody happy. And the second thing that we had a big problem with our CFO, the guy was not doing a good job when we kind of like figure out what was going on, because we hired like I wouldn't call a controller, but someone to like come and take a look at the numbers, homologated the numbers and everything. And he started to figure out like a bunch of bad like moves that the CFO did it, that put in the company some kind of debt and stuff.
So was it just a not an efficient way of doing things, or was he actually inaccurately representing numbers?
I would say that I was complete operation, like mistakes on the operation, doing bad decisions and not controlling the thing like really straight to the like the sense and everything.
So what is that one mistake that you can talk about that you can share here?
One mistake that we had that this guy figured out later on is that basically when things didn't look good on the cash flow, our CFO was like paying basically that's kind of how it works, and until this point is nothing wrong in there, but basically he will pay the people that are most important, like employees and really good providers and stuff, and kind of like leaving late other stuff, like things that they can do that, like banks and stuff. So a lot of interesting rates started to compound on that part, and he used to cover one hole, open the other. So when this controller guy comes to take a look, he was like, hey, there's a lot of mistakes in here, things that put the company in jeopardy. And I would say taking the blame out of the CFO, that was our fault as the founders and co-founders to not be closer to the numbers, in the meaning of like, okay, we bring in that amount of money in and everything is going out there, but why this, why that, why line one, number one, why line number two? We never had that much of like details, which kind of sounds stupid saying now, but it was kind of like trusting too much on the CFO to control this kind of things.
I see. And you were kind of like a startup mode, right? Where everyone is expected to be completely responsible for their time, because you don't even have the time.
Yeah, so much on our plates that like making the customer happy and acquire them. And the retention rate was like the thing for the company, because like I said, when you have only 5 customers, if you lose one of them and each one of them is like 1 million billing per month, you screw on the next paycheck. So you really need to make the guy happy. And that was like whatever me and Thiago and the whole team, kind of operational team on the marketing side and front end, was focusing. And we kind of leave all the back end of the company to the CFO and the other guys to take care. And that was a rookie mistake.
What was the revenue in the first year?
We did the revenue of 3 million in the first year.
In the first year. And as from what I remember, it was almost equal to the expenses, right? And there was no profitability. Is that right?
Right. Exactly. We had our break even after the second year and a half.
Second year and a half.
Yes. So it was like 2 years and a half just hustling our asses, keeping the valuation up. And one point that I didn't mention, the company was completely bootstrapped. So we didn't have any investors, any funds or any VCs on it. So that's something that really makes sense to have a longer break even, because you don't have any initial capital or anything. So we're putting money from the company. As soon as the company made some money, we reinvested to make growth more. We had a huge growth from 3 million the first year. We went to almost 4 or 5 in the second. And that was like a good growth rate for us. We didn't want to go more than that because of the limitation on the client portfolio. But the thing is that after the second year and a half, when we started to break even and everything, if we really had managed the numbers since the day number one, I would say that would be in a way better position to like starting to like cropping the profits from the company from that point.
Sorry, I didn't catch that. So if you had broke, if you were breaking even earlier than 2.5 years, is that the case you're talking about?
If we have planning and taking care of the numbers since the first month, I would say, after the 2 years and a half, when we were kind of like establish ourselves, the business, the clients, the billings, we could have a way better profit.
Got it.
Or way sooner if you would do that too, not in 2 years and a half.
I see. Instead of taking 2.5 years, you probably would have done it in 1.5 year. Even if you did it in 2.5 years, you would have been much more profitable and probably sold your company for much more later or something.
For sure. But we kind of fixed that mistake, I would say, with Xtrobo. Because Xtrobo had a way higher growth rate and extra ball. We break even since the first month.
I see. So the numbers you're mentioning for revenue, 3 million in first year and 5 million for second year, was it for Underdog only?
Only Underdogs.
I see. And how about for Extra Ball? How was it?
Extra Ball, her first year was already 1 million.
And profitable.
So
also.
It was like, it was not, yeah, but that's the difference. So we would say like, oh, Underdogs had 3 million and Extra Ball won. Why? Because Extra Ball was completely profitable. Because this 1 million that we had, it was amazing. We managed to get a lot of in our pockets, kind of like reinvesting in the second year of the company. The second year didn't grow that much. We went from 1 to 1.5, but was again super profitable.
I see. I want to soon get to the point where you decided to sell both companies and what you did over there. But before we get there, what happened during a Thanksgiving break in the marketing promotion?
That was a funny story. So we started to do some social media management and really kind of tackling on the kind of the side of the reputation and controlling the brand, how the users see the brand and what they're talking about, kind of like monitoring and polarizing this. So like, oh, this is a bad review, this is a good review, it's neutral. And we're kind of having talks back and forth with one of our clients, giant retail in Brazil, like same size as Walmart. And basically, we almost closed all this management with them before the biggest crisis in the company. We were so happy that we didn't close that deal when this thing happened. But I'll tell you what happened.
So what do you mean you were working with them but still didn't close the deal?
We were working with them on the PPC market and an SEO part. So paid and organic, but we didn't did anything regarding social.
Okay.
So that's why the huge crisis on social, that what happened basically.
Okay. So the deal that was not closed was the social part, which you're still kind of trying it out.
Yeah. The reputation management on the social media.
Got it.
That was the deal that we were glad that we didn't close it. Because exactly one week, like after we're starting to negotiate and everything, we had the Black Friday. And it was a huge mistake on the back end of the e-commerce. They basically, we joked that was the trainee guy, because that's kind of in Brazil, you always put the blame on the trainee.
Blame on the intern, you mean?
Yes, the intern, the trainee, exactly. So the guy basically, we don't know who in there, nobody knows actually, but the guy put a 30% off price on top off the Black Friday price.
Wow.
So if the Black Friday was 90% off or 50% off, the guy adds it up 30% more on top of that. So like they basically sold like half of the warehouse in like hours. And that warehouse supposed to last for like weeks, months. So people start to call it everywhere, like agency, all the platform, all the like people on the like ecosystem of the e-commerce try to figure out what was the problem.
And this was I just want to clarify here, this was not done by your guys, right? This was done by their own developers.
Okay. Yeah, their own in local team on their office, someone that puts the price, the Black Friday like discount tags. He put a 30% off on top of that.
So what did it mean?
They didn't figure out that was that the problem all the time. We did for them. That was a good thing too. So they started calling us. We started to like look around, figure out what was if the campaign was wrong, if the campaign was leading the guy to somewhere, if the websites had any bugs or like coupon codes that people were like hijacking or something. And we didn't find any like things out of the place, but it was so obvious and so explicit that the price was wrong that nobody noticed.
Okay.
So we started to look as like, hey, wait a second. This TV is really, really cheap, even for a Black Friday. So that was like, we called in. I was like, hey, your pricing is wrong, dude. Uh-huh. Someone put the wrong price on the website. So they are so desperate, they literally shut it off the website. And that was the biggest problem. Because when people were buying for like super discounts, they were happy. There was no problem going on just for them, right?
Yeah, it's only the company had the problem because they're running out of inventory.
Just losing on the margins. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like, okay, the customer was hell of happy with it. But when they shut it off the website because they kind of didn't figure out what was it and didn't have time enough to fix it, they just like unplugged the website, literally. Mm-hmm. And when they put it back on, everybody that had their like their products on their shopping carts and everything was gone. Or the price was updated on the checkout. So people are starting to freak it out. People are starting to like blasting social media, email support channels everywhere. Like, you guys are pigs. I was buying that for days and now it's dead. You change your prices in the middle of the Black Friday. That's not how a company should behave. Just like crushing the company. Mm-hmm. And we were like, oh my God, can you imagine if we close the country, we'll be the ones handling all that spam, all this complaining.
But you did, right? Even in that short period? Because all the social media was where it was impacted and you guys were dealing with the social media at that time.
I cannot say that we didn't help them because we did a lot, like providing a lot of feedback and support and everything, but we didn't actively management. We didn't like reply one comment by comment like we would do it if we had closed that contract. Okay. So it was like, whew, almost.
So you walked out of the deal at that
point? Yeah, we were out of the deal and we were happy about it because that would cost a lot of labor hours and everything to put everybody to like, we're probably going to do like a 24-hour workforce or anything like that just to like keep trying to keep up with the tickets Please. And the comments on the social media.
That's a great story.
That was one of the biggest things that we had in there.
Why did you decide to sell the companies?
Well, first thing, we're getting tired. That was the main reason. Especially my partner, he put it all like his money kind of it. Like I said, we bootstrapped it. So a lot of his money went down when the company was founded and to acquire the first customer, build the office, pay the first paychecks and everything. So after like 3 years, 4 years, he was done. He was really tired. He was not in his like physical, mental, bad, like good state anymore. Kind of we start to feel that a little bit. The company was not running super on the track. We had these problems on the financial part that were accumulating. So we're like, hey, let's try to figure out exit strategy here.
Do you remember the day he walked into the office and said, let's sell the company or let's figure out the exit strategy? Do you remember that day?
It was not a day. Okay. We had like our Friday meetings, we call it. So after Friday, instead of going to like the bars and everything for happy hour, we used to go to his apartment, hit downstairs on the pool and just like do a meeting at the pool. Mm-hmm. Just like chilling, drinking, and have some like conversations, brainstorming. And we've been discussing this for a few weeks. We're like, hey, things are getting hard. Well, where's the solution? Where's the instant solution? Where's the best way to go out of this? Or should we stay and for how long? So we've been had these talks for a while, I would say. And from that point, once we figure out that we want to explore this option, selling X in the company, we started to look around for people that were interested in all that, which didn't was not hard. Didn't take long to happen because a lot of people were interested because of the gross numbers, the clients that we mentioned. So when you have like a huge client and you have five of these and you put it in a front page and you say that you help these guys to reach huge numbers, it's mm-hmm. just a great sales pitch. And we did marketing, so we sell ourselves good.
So were you selling only the underdogs or both underdogs and extra ball?
Extra ball was super like under the cover. So like a lot of people didn't even knew about that because it was totally word of mouth. So we used to go do one from them projects. This guy will have for us for like 5-10 people. And remember what I said about the demand? The demand kind of spikes all that. It was so many people looking for that we didn't need to do any marketing, any acquisition at all. for extra ball just generate a revenue per demand. Mm-hmm. And Underdogs was a little bit different, like I said. But
so I was curious to know, how did you decide to bunch them together when you're trying to sell?
Right. So people approach us because of the Underdogs, because Underdogs had a front. People knew it because of the brand, and they start to negotiate with that. And like I mentioned to you, Underdogs has a few financial problems back in the time. Mm-hmm. So with that, people start to look at it and due diligence and all this kind of stuff. The numbers were like good, but not great. So we didn't have such good offers on that. So that's when comes the idea of like, hey, let's bundle Extra Ball, do a one big exit. We can like put the numbers way up using the profitability that Extra Ball has. It just look it great on the bookings. Mm-hmm. So that was the main point to bundle all together.
I see. So you bundled all together, and how long it took you from that point to actually going through and selling it?
It was about 6 months of back and forth with four different groups.
Four different potential buyers.
Yes, correct.
How do you decide who to sell it to?
Well, it was a mix of who paid more with whoever was easier to close it, I would say.
Okay.
Kind of like a lot of them, they all have huge contingencies. Like you need to vest in for that time. The founders and the VPs and C-levels need to stay in the company for that long. And you need to maintain that numbers and... Each one of them provide their own contingencies agreements. And we just look at the ones that make sense for us in a way that like fits our personal life and fits the company life. Mm-hmm. And after that, basically dollar amounts.
What did you sell it for?
I cannot disclose that, unfortunately.
Okay. Is it over $3 million?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was. Okay. It was because, like I said, bundling them together was good because Extra Ball had the profitability, which is great for just booking accountability and everything. And Underdogs has the portfolio, the big clients, the name and everything. So you got a kind of like good from both worlds. And whoever eventually acquires us, InfraCommerce, they're still active working on Brazil. It makes a lot of sense for them too. Because this group, they want to do like a GSI model. I don't know if you're familiar with the GSI here in US. GSI basically is like an end-to-end e-commerce solution. Mm-hmm. So say that you want to sell watches. You just go in there and say, hey, I have watches. That's it. Mm-hmm. They will take care from you, even since from the shipping, from the receiving in the warehouses, the picking, the packing, the e-commerce, the checkouts, the gateways, the payment, the shipping, the delivery, this customer support after his delivery, everything. It's an end-to-end solution.
These groups
want to do the same thing in Brazil. That's why he went ahead and acquired Underdogs as the marketing agency, Extra Ball as the front-end developer, another company as the help desk, another company as the platform, mm-hmm. and kind of close it up the whole cycle of solutions that he needed to provide an end-to-end solution.
I see. I think Amazon has a model called FBA, Fulfilled by Amazon, where they
Yes, really cool. They take care of the warehouse for you, basically. Yes.
Yep. Cool. So how did you celebrate your exit?
I have a really good point on that too. So I had an exit pretty young and everything. And
you were 22 at that time, right?
Yes.
Did the exit make you a millionaire?
No. Okay. On paper, yes. But that's the thing. People, I always say that to friends and family, especially people that were like, oh my God, I want to do a startup. I want to hustle for 5 years and become a millionaire. It just doesn't work like that.
Why not? It sounds legit, right? Like, what is wrong with that?
Well, you can do it for sure. But it's definitely not an easy path. Mm-hmm. And it's not a thing that everyone that does achieve it. I would say not even 1% of the people that tried probably do.
But you got there, right? You said you got there. You did have your exit. Why do you say you did not
I got it, but I didn't become a millionaire. So if the dream was to have 22 years old, become a millionaire and never work a day in my life anymore, that didn't happen.
Okay. No, what do you mean by on paper only? I just wanted to understand
sure.
what that is.
No, let me explain the part, because it's really like kind of important to like make sense of whatever I mentioned about the startup life and cycle. Basically, they have a lot of contingencies, like I said. So you need to be there for a specific amount of time, make like deliverables and a lot of things that specify, depends on the company that you're looking at. And on our case, we need to vest in our contracts for like 3 years. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen for me. So I was a millionaire in the paper because I'd have the shares equivalent to millions in the company, but I need to sit in there to get all my shares, and I need to exercise my shares, meaning buying the shares and everything when they're ready to be granted to me, the part that I could buy and the part that was just given to me in exchange of my previous companies. So I have this on paper. In the paper, I was a millionaire. But I need to vest and went through a lot of contingencies to have access to that money. So the just to summarize everything, if I was too much here and there, the dream is not easy, because one is to be a millionaire on paper and everything, or have a company that worth a million. Everybody can come here and start to pitch to VCs and make your pre-revenue company $1 million, $1 billion, whatever company. But that's not liquidity. That's not money on account. That's not cash. That's not something that you can go to the bank and buy a house. You do probably going to have a better lines of credit and everything, but you don't have liquidity.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. So I eventually exited with a nice deal. Mm-hmm. Something that put me in a position to like do the trip that I did, which is come to US, start to like hustling here for 1-2 years and figure out whatever I was looking to do for my next venture. But that didn't put me in a spot that I didn't need to work anymore, and I was a millionaire by 22 years old.
I see. So you are on paper and you don't have the, you have to wait it out to get all of it, and you did not. Wait for
you need to have it at all and everything. And in the end, you're going to have stocks, like I said.
Yeah.
You're not going to have liquidity on your bank account. And that stocks, if the company has IPO, if the company has acquisition, if the company has a merging, then your stocks will be converted to their values. So it's contingency to not... So the group that acquired us paid for both of the companies, Extra Ball and Underdogs, in shares. Mm-hmm. So of the big company. So I had a big slice of a cake that doesn't worth that much. Now I have a super small size of a cake that worth a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually this big cake that worth a lot needs also to be exited, merged or acquired by another person. So you can have the liquidity that you have on paper.
So the company who bought you were public already, right?
No, they're still running.
And they're not public.
They didn't acquire. So even though I had vested my contracts, I would still be like a stockholder in there.
Got it. Probably. So even the vested ones are just in the form of a stock, which are only valuable and liquid once they go public or someone else acquires, the big company who acquired you guys.
Yeah, basically that's on my contract, on all my partners too. That's when we have the chance to change our stocks from any form of cash equivalence.
I see.
If someone from the board or from the other partners from the group wants to buy your stuff, or if the company go through any of this process mentioned before.
Yeah. So I had a guest here earlier on my podcast who had a shares in a startup in 2000, which he held on to. And in 2010, they had an exit and he got a nice check in his bank account, which he used later to build another company. So you never know.
Yeah, you never know. I had friends that have like stock options in companies, and they join like in the first months, and the company will acquire like a few months after. Mm-hmm. That's already make you a million liquid. And sometimes it's way better strategy because you're not contingent on being a founder or co-founder or anything. So my advice to people that are looking to go to the startup life and everything, of course, if you have the desire and everything to go and be a founder, go ahead, do it. I totally incentivize it. That's the people that really change the world somehow. But if you just want to be part of a team that is already doing that, that is already on a mission, join an early stage company, a startup that just started, get a nice deal with stock options, starting to buy and invest in that stock options if you believe in the future of the company. Because then you eventually, in 1 or 2 years, you have a higher chance to have a good check come into your mail.
Nice. That's a great place to conclude, I would say. So, how do you think it went so far?
It went good. It went well. I think it was a great journey. The best thing so far was not the money, was the experience that I had. Because I keep saying that, like, if you want to grow, work with better people than you. If you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. Try to be in I was in a place that was, I was literally a kid. I was getting hit by every side. I was trying to stay on top of my game, and that made me become a way better professional in a way of being, know how to answer to people, have meetings, being resilience, all these kind of things that an entrepreneur needs to have it. You need to be able to go through stress times, negotiate, know how to talk to people, employees, peers. And that was my main kind of like taken away from the company. I learned all that in like 2-3 years.
It's a shortcut form to learn a lot of things at once.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Yuri, for joining us today. If someone wants to get hold of you, what is the best way for them to do it?
Yuri@yurimoreno.com or Yuri Moreno at Twitter. I'm there. So just shoot me a tweet or email. I'll be happy to answer, have some more talks, some private talks if you need it. I'm available. I love to discuss and bounce ideas back and forth.
Great. I will leave that in the show notes. Thanks, Yuri. Have a good one.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again, and have an amazing day.